We're going to share two sessions on called Fear and Faith in a Nuclear Age. And the first thing, I'm curious about how many of you will be leaving so you won't be able to come back tomorrow.
What time is here? When tomorrow?
Be the same time tomorrow.
Oh, okay.
So a few of you. So I'll keep that in mind, because normally when I've done this before, we end this first session with a certain amount of feelings of despair, and I hope nobody's leaving. And it reminds me of a story. I think this happened, that Dwight L. Moody used to had a scheme of having two night stances. You know who Dwight L. Moody was, a great revival preacher. And the first night he would preach fire and brimstone and sin and damnation. And then the second night, forgiveness and grace. And he went along doing that until once a Chicago fire happened after the first night. And he made it a commitment after that always to get both in the same sermon on the same night. I'd like to read a passage from Ephesians, 6th chapter, which will be a background, I think, of our discussion both today and tomorrow. Ephesians 6:10 and following. Finally, be strong in the Lord and in the strength of his might. Put on the whole armor of God, that you may be able to stand against the wiles of the devil. For we are not contending against flesh and blood, but against the principalities, against the powers, against the world rulers of this present darkness, against the spiritual hosts of wickedness in the heavenly places. Therefore, take the whole armor of God, that you may be able to withstand in the evil day. I'd share a beginning of how I became involved in this subject in the last several years. I have somewhat of what you might call a quiet personality, never have been involved in being out in the forefront of controversial issues. When I started going out speaking on the arms race, my mother wrote me a letter and said, "You realize you're in a controversial area." And I like to say sometime, only this is a joke, but during the Vietnam War, I was a mild protester. I was among those who boiled their draft cards. So it's not true, but it's a funny joke. Several years ago, I read an article or an essay by Jim Wallace on the issue of slavery in the 1900s in our country. And in this article, he reminded that most clergy said nothing about slavery. You know, and some would say certainly it was the number one moral issue of those days in the 1900s, early 1900s. Most clergy said nothing. And when I was reading this, I remember he did what a good essay should do, get inside of you. And while I was reading this part, I was saying, I surely would have been one of those courageous abolitionists. And then he turned and reminded that the nuclear arms race is, maybe as slavery is, the number one moral issue of our day. And the thought then, it just struck me, and I think this is maybe what Luther meant when he talked about the law driving us. It struck me that I'd really never mentioned this issue in the pulpit or in teaching or even in counseling, or I'd been very quiet about it. And I saw myself right with all the clergy during the slavery days that went on really justifying it by saying nothing. So that began to make me aware of this issue. But then the change really came for me, or how I got involved in this, I call it, through the stubbornness of my older brother, who's a pastor in Colorado Springs and is stubborn. And he told me that he was in charge of getting a speaker to lead a workshop for the Rocky Mountain and Nebraska synods of the LCA on the nuclear arms race, and I would be the speaker. And I said no, because I haven't studied this issue. And he wouldn't take no for an answer, and then talk to me about his real reason for wanting me to do this is because I had just moved to Holden, which means that before we lived in Albuquerque and could get together a lot. And he says, this is a wonderful excuse for you to come to Colorado so we can get together again. So I said yes. And so when I came here to Holden and spent several months getting ready for this workshop, and then out of that study really came a little booklet that's in the bookstore, By Faith Alone, a Lutheran Looks at the Bomb. And I like to make it clear it's a Lutheran looks at the bomb and not the Lutheran look at the bomb. You know, it's a person that's in the Lutheran tradition that looks at the nuclear arms race, and then this book really is my own personal testimony as I respond to this issue as a Christian who is also a Lutheran. So that's how I became involved, and then there was kind of this tide in the church of interest in this issue. In a way, that tide of tremendous popularity has gone over. But during that tide of maybe 2 years ago, I got invited to speak a lot on this issue. So that's how I became involved. I'd like to share this morning a beginning by pointing you to this chart. Maybe most of you, I'm just curious how many have seen this chart. Well, it's maybe about a third of you. I think it's a chart that really helps us enter into this issue. The chart is not a ceiling, you know, these little ceiling squares. But if you'll notice, this square in the middle is blank except for one dot. That one dot represents all the firepower that was detonated during the entire Second World War, including Hiroshima and Nagasaki. All the firepower of the Second World War. 3 million tons of TNT, or what we call today 3 megatons, the entire Second World War. Okay, then if you take each dot on the chart represents an entire Second World War. And then if you take all the dots on the chart, count them if you want to afterwards, that represents the firepower that is available to us, we who are sinful human beings, in the world today in the form of our nuclear weapons. The little circle there is the firepower available in one Poseidon submarine, 3 World War IIs, and then 9 World War IIs circled here is the power available in one Trident submarine. The larger circle is meant to circle 100 dots. And this is the firepower needed to destroy every medium and large city in the entire world in that little circle. You know, I look at this chart and it never becomes something I'm used to. I look at it again and again. And by the way, the newer charts have added 2 more squares with some more dots. You know, the reminder that every day we build 3 to 5 nuclear warheads in our country, the Soviet Union, probably the same. This chart has power to me, but also I think of the things that it doesn't say. You know, it doesn't tell us about the increase in the sophistication of our delivery systems, which in themselves many would say is destabilizing. The movement to perfect the aiming of our weapons towards military targets, which moves us towards what some call the area of first strike. Or the cruise missile type that moves into the area beyond inspection, again destabilizing. The delivery systems now that from Western Europe can deliver a bomb to the Soviet Union with an 8-minute time, meaning they have 8 minutes to decide if it's false alarm or if it's a true attack. So what the chart doesn't show is all of these different very destabilizing things that our technology does as technology kind of pulls the thing along. By the way, I wanted to share that I want to present something here in maybe a half hour this morning, and then just open it up to all the responses you might have. In my sharing, I have this concern, and I made this a dedication from the very beginning of studying this issue. I went into this knowing that I am not a scientist or a technician or an expert on arms control or anything, and I had to go into it with this thought of what I have to give to this area is to try from my own theology to try to get some handles on this issue that is so fearsome and so threatening. So I try to keep the discussion on how do we understand this biblically and how do we understand it theologically. I begin, I think for me it helps to think in terms of some images or imagination, you might say. Some things that come to my mind is when I was a freshman in college, there was one fellow on our dorm floor that got drunk every weekend and would become violent and out of control. And I remember it took six of us to hold him down. We would literally sit on his arms and his legs as his body was totally out of control. Or I remember Catherine was a woman in Albuquerque, New Mexico, where I was a minister, and I ministered to her during her last weeks of life. Cancer so out of control that the cells or the tumors were bulging out of her eye sockets during her last week. And it's images like that that I think of when I think of this, that Robert McNamara in 1962, I think it was, said that we need 200 to 400 warheads to deter the Soviet Union. And now we can deliver over 10,000. And you have to say we've moved beyond what the official policy has told us as deterrence to something that, to me, I can only think of in terms of images of bodies that have gone out of control. Okay, now one way I enter this is something that's come to me largely through a study of both scripture and the baptism of the early church. Lee Griffin, who's a psychologist here in the Northwest, when he was at Holden, put it in a sentence that really helped me. He says, "The church preaches a radical gospel against the background of a pastel evil. We joyfully proclaim the liberation of the gospel, but we hesitate, I suppose as my mother told me in the letter, it's controversial, we hesitate to name the captivity that that gospel would free us from." And I think of the seriousness that the New Testament and the seriousness that the early church took, the clutching powers of the evil forces in this world. If you were going to be baptized in the early church for the whole season of Lent, you would have your morning exorcism. And the exorcist would lay hands and pray over you and blow in your face and do all kinds of things to blow evil forces out of you. Now, when I was in seminary, I learned it was called the sophisticated gospel. That meant you never said anything in teaching or preaching that might offend the intellect. And one of those was ever to talk about demonic powers. And I remember in my first congregation I served in St. Charles, Illinois, I even had one very intellectual person that checked me every Sunday to make sure I didn't say anything that offended intellect. This is the church where Don teaches now. I hope you're carrying on this tradition. He isn't there anymore. Something offended him. So what I'd like to begin now by being, first of all, stating this, that when I move into what I call areas of demonic powers now, that anyone here who's in the military or been in the military, as I read in the book of Ephesians, we are not contending against flesh and blood. No, I'm not speaking against anyone, but I'm raising a question: have we been captivated by a system? And I need to say that because I look back in the congregations I served, and some of the most caring people for me personally were people in the military. Remember, especially, I served a congregation in San Diego. Member was a major in the Marines, and the only lay person that I've ever known in serving in the parish would every several months take me out to lunch and just ask me, how are you feeling and how's it going? And I trusted him. And I give thanks to God that I have that in my baggage, you know, that I don't lash out against military people or people that are in the, specifically in the industry, but try to pull them in to ask these questions about the theological question of evil powers in the world. Okay, with that, well, I just add this one thing that I think amplifies this. That the worldwide military budget is over $600 billion, and some say it's moving to $1 trillion. And that is in a world where 500 million people are hungry. I think I just read that in third world countries now, arms purchases have overtaken food purchases. Now, I'd like to back up from that and try to get a theological handle on this. And I'll just show you now the work I have done in this area, really out of what I've tried to have a biblical faith, and also some of the what we call Lutheran handles. If there, do you know there is such a thing? Lutheran handles to get on problems. Okay. But I'll... what's been helpful to me is what Lutherans have said about the orders of creation. Oh, that's a big hunk, isn't it? It's like an overkill. Orders of creation. Orders of creation, we say, are the institutions that are created by God as a gift to us to really hold human life together and make humans living together and living in this world a possibility. They're the systems that hold it together, hold life together. And just what would some of them be? Some of the obvious ones.
Government.
You know, and under government, those of us in the Lutheran tradition would say military is part of the government that serves the people.
Law.
What?
Law.
You know, the whole legal systems.
Mm-hmm.
And probably the primary system that holds our life together is our family.
Oh.
Was anybody here born and dumped in the woods? And made it. No. Yeah. You were, tell us about it. Oh. Yeah. Then you could just go on, you know, to educational systems. I won't write them all down. The recreation systems, church, religious systems. You know, these are, then very important, economic systems. In the book The Fate of the Earth, Jonathan Schell, he brings out this point that I don't know exactly how he said it, but if you did crawl out of your bomb shelter and there's no safe way, I mean, what do you do? And now, when we go back to creation, we say, as Lutherans, and I think this is very biblical and it's life-affirming and it's creation-affirming, that all of these orders were created by God as gifts to humans, family and government, and these institutions, and we say they're good. And I think it's an affirmation of our church that I hold, and I hold very dearly. Now, I want to move now that to just, I'm going to be drawing a comparison now between myself as an individual creation and also the orders of creation. I am also created good, and the Hebrew in the Old Testament is a wonderful word for it. And God said, God looked at everything God had made, and behold, it was good. Tov. And it's a feeling if you're an artist and you finally create a sculpture that you like. Have any of you taken art classes and you can't stand anything you do? And then one day it happens, and there it is, and you stand back and, ah, that's Tov. That's Tov. And God looked at what God had made, and it was Tov. And that's me to a creation of God. Now, the next affirmation is that as one created good, I fall. I am fallen. Now, I'll share what I think that means to me. I was walking downtown San Diego once, and when there aren't a lot of people on the street, it's significant when there's only one, and you're only one, and you're coming close, and those psychological tests we used to take in school would ask you if you would cross the street. Remember that? But I didn't, but I noticed as this person came closer, the greasy hair going back, a t-shirt rolled up with the cigarettes in the sleeve, tattoos on the arms, and as he passed me, I looked just to the side and glanced, and the tattoo on his arm was a heart, and it said, "Born to Love." And I'm bashful, but so I don't do things like this, but I wanted to just run after him and say, "That's it." That is what the human being is created to be. That's what I'm created to be, with God and nature and creation, other people, the animals, born to love. Probably not what he meant. But what when I fall? My fallenness is my turning from the very being that God created to be in its beauty and its wonder. To turn from that being born to love, I turn in on myself. Now, I like to make the suggestion that's been helpful to me that we also live in a world of fallen orders. And if you work for Safeway, this might be hard to take, but Safeway is fallen. Okay. I'll explain that. No. Or whatever industry or institution you're involved in, just say to yourself, now it is fallen. Which means simply what it means for me as an individual, that the orders were created to serve human beings. And the orders have a tendency to turn also from their created task to serve themselves and then call the human beings that are related to them to serve them. And institutions do this. We just have to observe, and therefore we say they too are fallen. You notice now I'm taking the orders and almost giving them a personality. And that's going to lead me into what is, I think, a Pauline theology. I'm almost giving them a personality. Jesus had a sense of this fallenness of orders when he said the Sabbath was made for humans and not humans for the Sabbath. The Sabbath was a religious order or institution, and it was turning, as Jesus saw, from serving humans to having humans serve them. Okay, now let's take it another step. There is a point that I think, and this is a hard one, but there is a point where I, in my fallenness, could move to a point that is beyond control, where I might be called having become demonic. This is a slippery area to talk about. But I think there's a sense that we could become so overpowered by the forces of evil that we would go beyond being fallen to being demonic or just simply out of control. Now, I got to back up because I forgot something. As Lutherans, we insist, and I think this is important, that fallen orders of creation are still used by God in God's love for the good of human life. Or it's another way of saying some government may be better than no government. Do you know what I mean? It's still the fallen orders still are used by God in God's love. And I think it's what traditionally Lutherans have sometimes called the left hand of God or the other kingdom in the two kingdoms. Fallen orders still used by God in love to hold human life together and make getting up in the morning, doing the human thing, and going to bed at night a possibility. That's God's love. Now, where my mind went was then to ask this question, do human orders, the orders of creation, also have within themselves the possibility of going berserk or going out of control? And I think we would say yes when we think of examples. One would be the governmental system of the Nazis. It gradually went to a point that we would say it became demonic, and we would say that only words like demonic begin to fit when you realize how that government moved. Or you might think of when you see the picture of Jim Jones, the People's Temple, and the bodies lying on the ground that had drunk the poison. You would say here was a religious institution that had become demonic and totally out of control. You following me? I'm speaking now. That is a that's a hard one. If Jim Jones is an individual, or there was something about the whole system, but I'm talking mainly about a system, and even suggesting that both Hitler and Jim Jones might have been much a victim of their system as anybody else. So, right. Now, if you look at these, there's some characteristics begin to emerge. Another system might be the economic system of slavery, or the system of apartheid that, as you can see now, has demonic aspects to it as it continues to move in history. And when you look at these, as I just said, a number of characteristics begin to emerge. One is that the system itself becomes kind of a god. And by god, I mean it makes promises of salvation. By salvation, I mean the rescue from a meaningless life. The promise of ultimate salvation, though, is given by the institution. Then the institution has people who believe what is called the lie of that salvation, and therefore the people give themselves totally and completely to the institution, believing that that institution will bring them salvation. And then the third characteristic certainly would be that because that institution is not God, it finally fails the people and brings about disaster and catastrophe. So you have those characteristics, I think. The promise of salvation, the people worshiping that system as divine, and finally the system unable to keep the promise and the coming of disaster. Okay, then, are you following me so far? Is this... Now, I'd like to give a quote from Adolf Hitler's minister of propaganda shortly before the end of the war. It's an interesting quote. "Even if we lose, we shall win, for our ideals will have penetrated the hearts of our enemies." Okay, now I'm going to just share a perception of, I think, how we and our so-called adversaries, the Soviet Union, both came out of the Second World War. I think we both came out we succeeded in stopping Hitler, and I think that helped us to believe, both of us, that the way to solve problems on this earth is by brute force. And some would certainly say the Second World War was close to a justifiable war. in stopping Hitler as the war did. But then as this minister of propaganda, maybe the ideal of Hitler was easily taken over by the victors. And then both sides came out of that war with a tremendous fear. And I think for us in the United States, it was two very tremendous fears. One, that we wouldn't go back to the Depression, and the other, that Pearl Harbor would never happen again, never, never happen again. And I think the Soviet Union came out of that war with also a never again, when you think that 20 million of its people died in that war, and the Soviet Union was devastated by that war, and also this never again. And I would raise this question. Did something happen in the idea of brute force being the way to overpower the world, or the way to exercise power in the world, along with these tremendous fears that brought about what is now called the worldwide arms race? That I will share now what the perception that I have reached, that I think the worldwide arms race more and more fits into the description I gave of an order of creation, the order being the military part of the government, having gone out of control, having gone berserk, now having given the world a promise of salvation, and the world believing that promise, and the world giving all to that promise. The vision is a world that we lived in of a great bomb and the people of the world surrounding that bomb in worship. I think just indications that half of the scientists and technicians in this world work on building weapons or some type of military. And again, while all of this is happening with 1 billion people in poverty, a half a billion hungry, 40,000 children die every day of hunger. In 1980, the United States sold $9 billion worth of weapons to other nations. In 81, we jumped from $9 billion to $25 billion. These are just some of the things. In my perception, I began looking beyond this. You know, some people would say, well, deterrence is working. Well, again, I had my first question when I look at this chart and call that deterrence. But then when you read about our nation and just the physical things of crumbling bridges and crumbling dams and crumbling sewer systems, schools that go begging, deficit to pay for all this that is really taking money from our children and our grandchildren and jeopardizing their future, and then the hungry and the poor with less and less and less. I begin to ask the question that will be the gospel for this Sunday: are we selling our souls, or are we losing our souls? And there's some things that become undefinable, or we can't talk about them in terms of statistics. The family violence, the violence against children, the violence of our prison system, sexual abuse, all of these parts of our society, is it part of a larger whole, at least in part, that after the Second World War we sold ourselves to an idea that brute force is a way to live in this world? Well, I'll stop here in a minute, but I see the world. Remember how I said a demonic power finally brings destruction, and I feel that we're moving closer and closer and closer. And we're not talking about a glamorous war, but we're talking about war in its very ugliest. This year, Karin and I were at Hiroshima in the museum to get a little picture of what kind of war we're talking about. Only so much more of millions frying in the thermal heat, or running from the firestorms, crying for water, wishing to die, or later cancerous bodies, and the mutations and the ecological destruction, and even the possible death of Earth. And where I get angry is when I think of the people who are also captives of the system. But where will they be but deep in safe underground caverns or high-altitude control airplanes? And where would I be and my loved ones and the dear people and the people of this earth? We who believed what I would call a lie, we would be the ones that are burning. Now, what I've shared with you is my perception and my theological journey, and I want you to hear this is mine and not something I'm pushing on everyone, but it's more and more makes real to me what is said in 1 Peter: the devil goes around like a roaring lion trying to devour, or the New Testament word that the devil is a father of lies, and the danger of believing a lie, and the danger of a church not calling a lie a lie. Well, that's, I see a world deceived. And now, where I'd like to end with a little word of hope for the five who won't be here tomorrow. Because tomorrow I want to say, what is the hope in this worldwide situation? And I hope you notice I wasn't just talking about the United States, but a worldwide situation. Where is the hope? And again, something Luther that taught me that has touched me so deeply is the theology of the cross. And Luther had no idea of the nuclear age when he talked about that where we meet God is in the darkness and in the pain of this world, because that's where Jesus is on the cross. And I've found for myself what keeps me alive and keeps me going is the deeper I go into the darkness in the nighttime of the nuclear arms race and worldwide militarism, and what I call it as its captivating powers of this world, the deeper I go into that, the closer I come to the crucified Jesus, who is there and stands there and suffers there, and there calls us to a new life. And I don't know what I would do without the theology of the cross. The opposite is that theology that says you have to leave all of this and find some religious fantasy land to find God. But I go into this, and that's where God meets me. And tomorrow I want to share what I think God says and shares with us as God meets us, and mainly and finally, what God is doing. And that's my final joy. It's not what I am doing or what I could do, but when I go into that darkness to see the rustling of God, you know, the quiet rustling of God in that darkness and in that gloom. That's what we'll look at tomorrow. So if you can possibly come back. Okay, that's my sharing, and I hope you were able to follow my kind of theological journey and also very personal journey I've taken into this issue. Now I invite your disagreements, questions, challenges, your feelings, especially was at a conference once where several college students got up to respond after a speech on the nuclear arms race. Two very sophisticated college men got up and gave outstanding little speeches. A college woman walked up to the mic, got three words, and started crying. You know, and some would say, oh, it's a woman. But when I heard those tears, I said, this is the profoundest reaction that any human soul could have. So share how you feel or what you think or your perceptions.
Oh. One thing that always disturbs me relates to the chart that you had up there with all the dots. In a number of our periodicals, there are articles which are often written that suggest that the USSR is ahead of us in total numbers. And I think the chart shows better than anything that kind of an argument is sheer insanity. Why should we try to have more weapons than the other side when only a very small portion of the weapons that just could destroy the entire world? And yet, those kinds of arguments and some of our major periodicals in this country are accepted by people who believe that more money than that must be put into weapons in order that the Russians will not be ahead of us. The whole way that we reason in that sense is wrong.
It's been helpful. I try every time I read the newspaper or anything to try to use my theological handles. And it's my encouragement to church people, you know, if you don't agree with me theologically, fine, but at least use your theology, you know, to try to get, and don't go into it just as an American or just as something else. And it's been helpful to me once you have a sense outside of the situation what an order of creation that has become demonic, that order, instead of human beings controlling it, it has certain ideas that are in the air that are what pull the human beings along to continue believing the lie. And I think that's been on both sides. You know, both the Soviet Union and the United States are captivated. And what's kind of kept the last thing an order wants to do is quit. And for both sides to say, oh, we are just catching up. The power of justification. It's called...
One other comment, too. I found... I don't know how many people have played the game of Risk. It's a game where you have a board with the whole world on it, and you have your little army piled up. And I experienced something interesting doing that one time, because you try to take over a whole continent, of course. And I had South America in this game, and somebody else had America, you know, North America. Now, I wanted to make sure that person couldn't come through and wipe me out. So I kept on putting a few extra armies on Central America there. Now, the other person interpreted that, not as a defensive move, but as an offensive move, that I was going to try to come up and swing through and capture him. So what we got is a continuing building up on each side, always interpreting the other side as being the one who's going to wipe you out. And I think that's exactly what happens in the world. And it's potentially very destructive.
Yeah. There's a hand here, and then let's go over.
hardly know where to begin with this because it's a new. I've just been thinking about the last few weeks and the discussions, you know, that we have concerning this. We always are dealing with the notion of the buildup and the gradual the lowering of the bombs and such. And I don't recall ever hearing a serious argument to the notion of what would happen if we actually decided to lay down all of our arms one-sided or unilaterally. You know, we always have the struggle. You wouldn't want to do it unilaterally. And I'm certainly not advocating anything. I don't mean to advocate anything with this question. But there seems to be somewhere it seems we should have some thoughts concerning what if we lay down unilaterally the entire West, the non-communist world, our arms, allowing ourselves to be ruled and overrun by the enemy, losing our democratic form of thinking and all of our, losing our, what we consider what we want. And can something in the notion of the whole armor of God reawaken another way of doing battle rather than with arms? I think I got the start of the idea was from Peter Leakey. He wrote a book called People of the Lake, which was his interpretation of some of his ideas of what they have really found in archaeology concerning the ascent of man. And he brings out the notion of the stone axe, and the blunt instruments and such, and the spears, that there is nothing in archaeology, as he sees it, that tells us that these were invented to use in violence against another man, but only in the violence of taking animals or some such nature, but not as a war. And we've grown up with this idea that we must, that weapons are part of us, that we are territorial, that we are these aggressive people. Well, he throws a little doubt there. Maybe we are not that aggressive people. And I rather like that idea. Maybe it's just because it sounds good to me, but I have a tendency to believe there's some real truth. But is there anyone who is writing and really thinking in terms of let's say, what happens if we all decide to allow ourselves to be overwhelmed by the enemy and the evil forces and battle them from some notion of the total armor of God? I don't know. I'm throwing that as a question.
Yeah, two responses. You know, one, I found when I present this, trying to look theologically at the arms races, it's always important to say that I'm speaking to the church and not speaking to the United States government as to what kind of policy. You know, because some people get very frightened that they think that I'm going to convince enough people that we will have unilateral disarmament. I'm far from that. The second, if you want to pursue that question, is to go into the whole area of nonviolent defense systems. Very interesting. Even the Pentagon has done study, you know, that it's part of our the problem of what I called our belief system, that we've tended to talk about defense only within the narrow bonds of violent defense. Ron Sider in Nuclear Holocaust and Christian Hope has a brief introduction to that. Actually showed how the Norwegians did it in a wonderful way during the Second World War. You know, it was finally the violent overthrow that, you know, ended the war, but it's a fascinating story of nonviolent. You know, some would say the Germans never conquered Norway. You know, it's an interesting field to study.
Comment and then question at the end of the symposium. Madison, University of Madison last fall, Position for Social Responsibility, had a very interesting presentation on all the dynamics of what happens, you know, given all the pictures and the medical consequences of nuclear wars, so it's basically on. Met a fellow who was about 71, a physician from in Boston, Dr. Clark, came up, and he said, "We don't even have a language to describe, because war is inadequate. When you talk about nuclear war," he said, "it's really not an adequate term." And I thought it interesting that here from the medical profession, you know, very scientific and pretty much looking in that vein, and he used the term demonic. He used that term. And that was a word of hope for me, that physicians are now looking at this and who else besides maybe, what other kinds of groups are now
looking at this in a more focused sort of way. That's my question.
I heard on the news just before coming up here that the Russian positions have taken a similar position.
To me, it's as a Christian, it's a big step for me to move over into the area of calling the nuclear arms race, and I would also call it the whole worldwide arms race as demonic. But it's also hopeful, because then you say the battle in this world is a spiritual battle, and what this must be countered with is spiritual weapons. And the church maybe has a greater task than trying to help its government decide what to do, but rather the church has to get its army together. That's what we're going to talk about tomorrow.
Just a response, and then something. Okay. One woman at the end, she said, "We have to do something." She said, "The greatest antidote to despair is action."
Uh-huh. Yeah. The most hopeful people are people that are doing.
You're talking about a global Holocaust, and I'm worried about even something on a smaller scale. I don't know how many have read the Crash of 79.
The what?
Has anyone ever read Crash of 79? It was a novel about a nuclear, small scale nuclear explosion in the Middle East and the chaos that followed afterwards. And it's so frightening that it could happen, you know. It would have to be us versus them. Some small incident in a strategic part of the world and the chaos non-nuclear could happen afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
And another thing that frightens me is the kind of phobia with the Star Wars defense system or something, but it exploded the nuclear weapons out in space before they could put it down.
Mm-hmm.
Frightens me to see what would happen to the whole atmosphere cooling with nuclear deaths.
Yeah. One thing I forgot to mention when I was talking is one example of how much we do give, you know, and the Star Wars defense system, if we go into that, it's we're going to have to give and give, and there in the Old Testament, one definition of an idol is insatiable appetite. From Daniel. I'll bring the passage tomorrow what to read. But the current five-year program that is anywhere between $1.6 and $1.7 trillion, Time Magazine broke that down to the average American family will pay $20,000. $20,000 per family. You know, and then the Star Wars defense system, you know, it's going to mean $30,000 a family, maybe. I'm guessing, but insatiable appetite, you know. And once we believe that answer, then what follows is give, and it never stops.
I think just from my own point of view, the single thing that keeps the armies going from this point of view is a lack of trust of the this enemy or the Soviet Union or whatever you want to call it. And, you know, it's great to talk about all the destructive potential, but I think somehow you have to be able to trust the adversary or whatever the Soviet Union is before anything meaningful can be done, other than laying down arms and having unilateral disarmament.
Mm.
I'm not sure what the answer to that problem is, and of course that's what everything is trying to figure out an answer to that.
Yeah. I don't know. Do you want it? Good.
First of all, I campaigned for somebody I believe a lot in this last year, George McGovern, who was asked if he was in favor of unilateral disarmament, and responded by saying, unilateral freeze, nuclear weapons freeze, and simply said, if the Soviet Union wants to continue to spend money on nuclear weapons, that's their problem, with that chart in mind.
Mm-hmm.
There's not a need any longer to continue to build the weapons. At a point where we can cut them off, and maybe start dismantling a lot of them. And another one is, if we have the capacity to create weapons that destroy the world, maybe we also have the capacity. In fact, a lot of people have said that we do have the capacity to not have to worry about just the word of the Soviet Union. We can create satellites that can take pictures of from outer space of a license plate in Moscow.
Mm-hmm.
So we do have the capacity to not have to trust them.
It's an interesting thing how strangely we accept information.
because we can be so confident, you see, of that kind of accuracy, and yet at the same time we are afraid that there is no verifiability of our lack of going on. Jonathan King, a professor at MIT, who's very much involved with scientists against war these days, told an audience last year that the people at MIT who are working on the guidance systems for missiles, just doing their job, without any moral commitment in particular, they're just doing their job. They can hit not just the general hospital in Moscow, but they can hit the delivery room in the general hospital in Moscow. That's how powerful and precise these weapons are. But then we hear the Russians are behind, or this business of they have more weapons, like it's a big snowball fight, you know. It's a snowball fight, the number of snowballs makes a lot of difference. But that's really not true. We accept such strange contradictions as being information mm-hmm. and swallow them.
I'm curious, when I have chosen myself to use words like demonic, does that seem spooky, or does it touch a sense of reality with
what
you?
What it is to me is it'd be very easy for me to be so demonic. But then one of the first questions, if it's demonic, then what do, then how do I view my civic duties of voting? Mm-hmm. If I understand right, the Mennonites, for instance, don't vote or participate in government because they, is that true?
No, that would be a misconception. That would fit more Jehovah's Witnesses, but and there would be some Mennonites that would say that, but the most Mennonites in the leadership are very active participants in the political process.
But if a system is evil, on one end, it's probably evil on the other end, too.
Yeah, it's, because what you're bringing up is really the, the almost frightening area you enter into when you say my government is involved in what is a worldwide demonic system. I can just share where I've come down on that. I mean, I still, I don't say the United States government is demonic or has reached a state of being demonic like the Nazi government. At that point, then a Christian would be called to totally step outside and resist, or stay inside and resist too, like Bonhoeffer did. But I would say my government is involved in a demonic system or a worldwide system that's gone out of control. And in that area of my government's work, when I've made this decision for myself, then my Christian response is to resist and say I will say no to it in every way I can, both by participating in the government system and also protesting. For me, it's been a matter of tax resistance just say, the power of saying no. But if you could understand, I see a difference between my whole government, and this one system that the government is involved in here.
I'd like to explain the demonic idea, too. I think as Christians, we can be sort of hopeful even when we're dealing with what the demonic is. I've seen a lot of people carrying around the book by M. Scott Peck, The Road Less Traveled here. And I've read that, and he has a new book called The People Who Lie, The Hope for Healing of Human Evil. And I haven't read that book, but I've read some parts of it, and I also remember some of the things he said in Road Less Traveled about evil being, this is my interpretation, so it's open to criticism, but an absence of a sense of community, thinking that you are the person around whom the world revolves, and no vision of what the rest of the world is doing, or thinking that the world should serve your needs. Mm-hmm. And that's what evil is, when you get to an absolute state where there's just total alienation or separation. And that's why I've appreciated you're talking about this, not in terms of just the United States or the Soviet Union, but it's a problem that the whole world has and a lack of a vision for community. And as Christians, we have maybe a special responsibility to just vision community and not take sides. And when people ask about the Russians, not just try and defend, the Russians or just try and defend the United States. It's the world's problem.
Yeah, tomorrow I want to share a vision. I think we have a power that, we've hardly begun to discover. If some There's just time enough to wash your hands and go to the bathroom for first lunch, but some of
them. In that order?
Yeah, whatever you want to do, it's up to you. Some want to just stay and keep talking a few minutes. I go to second lunch, so welcome to space.